in the principle of dynamic and flexible, this is not one of these places where the call can schedule for the next 2 years. Next week is Peter Coles, who is a cosmologist and astrophysicist from Nottingham, who is going to be doing something provocative in human cosmology. 2 weeks after that, so there's something to be filled in there. We have Bob Holden, who is a particle physicist from Toronto, who has been doing something in foundations of quantum mechanics with a classical stochastic information quantum theory that they claim is equivalent to quantum field theory. On January 11th, Anthony Valentini puts together the two preceding themes, and we'll talk about predictions for cosmology from some theories of hidden variable theories, foundations of quantum mechanics. Then we have two talks opening our minds to real science, which is experimental physics. Julian Buryak from Alberta will be talking about the field of nanoscience, nanophysics, nanochemistry. And then Laura Vargas from Florida will be updating us on experimental dark matter searches, which I think is a beautiful intro to today's talk, and John will make an introduction.
It was a pleasure to welcome Professor Philip Van Dyne from the Institute, just basically. Philip did a PhD at Oxford University of Israel in the 60s, and he spent 2 years this year studies in Princeton, and he's now a professor, has been professor of physics at the University of Connecticut, and as great as a president. And what else would you like to show you here? Philip is one of these rare physicists who is well versed in relativity, that stands the subject. But he's also an expert in the astronomy and astrophysics, which he has developed an expertise over quite some years. This is a great combination, and it's the basis for this talk, in which he will discuss this strange situation. 96% of the universe, as we know it's composed, is invisible. And some of it's left. Let's see the talk.
First of all, very nice to be here. Thank every one of you for this very kind invitation. I very much enjoyed being here the last few days. And I want to describe to you some problems that exist in physics today, which I think are very, very basic, and in some sense the community is avoiding. If you pick up any newspaper, you will read that the universe consists of 30% of matter, which is called dark matter, which has this wonderful property of being invisible, and then it's accompanied by another 70% of material, which is called dark energy. The difference between the two is that dark matter has positive pressure, and dark energy has negative pressure. So we're faced today with a universe which is predominantly composed of these two components, both of which are invisible, one of which has positive pressure, and the other of which has negative pressure. This is called dark energy, though perhaps it should have been called dark pressure. And what I want to describe to you today is, how on earth did we get to come to that conclusion? And is it a valid conclusion? And is there a possibility that at this late stage, one can argue that no, the universe is composed of luminous matter, and what you see is what you get? So that's the viewpoint I'm going to take today. I'm going to argue that the case for dark matter and the case for dark energy is are somewhat the same as the case for weapons of mass destruction, and that the outcome may be the same. On the other hand, I see you've got a speaker coming on January the 25th who might announce to you that, yes, dark matter has been discovered. So I will ask you to listen to my words with some caution in case that might occur. There are two different kinds of dark matter problems, and there are two different kinds of dark energy problems. The original dark matter problem is best exemplified in these particular rotation curves. If you take the solar system and you just plot the orbits of the planets around the sun, then you find that they fall off as Kepler would expect, and that led us to the inverse square law. And when you do exactly the same thing for the motion of objects around galaxies, you see that this is the expectation of Kepler. This is how the velocity should fall off as a function of distance from the center if Newton's law of gravity is applied to the visible matter alone. And on the other hand, you see that, in fact, the velocities are much larger. If you go back to the very early days of gravity theory, it was found that when people looked at the velocity of Uranus, it wasn't quite where Newton said it was supposed to be. And people suggested that maybe there's another planet out there which is pulling it a little. And that was, of course, Neptune. And then Neptune was discovered. So Neptune today would be called dark matter. And the discovery of Neptune, I believe, was the first successful prediction of dark matter theory. And I would also argue that for the moment, it's the only successful prediction of dark matter theory. But nonetheless, it worked. However, the modification of the orbit of Uranus due to the presence of Neptune was something like 1 part in 10 to the 5. Very small effect. There was a second problem with the solar system. Of course, you know, the motion of Mercury didn't quite fit the expectation of Newton. And what Newton proved is a wonderful theorem, and that is that when an object goes in an orbit, it comes back to exactly the same place as where it started from the previous time round, if the potential is exactly 1 over r. And it was found that this didn't occur. And people looked very hard to see maybe there was another planet there that they missed. They postulated the existence of Vulcan. Vulcan was shown not to exist. There was no other planet in the inner solar system. And this, of course, was the first failure of dark matter theory. And at that point, people realized that something had to be done, something special. Somehow you had to change the law of force. And Einstein gave the answer that there is a curved space correction. And that is a modification to the orbit, which is a 1 part in 10 to the 8 modification. Again, a very small effect, but an effect which confirmed the notion of curved spaces. Here, when we go out to galaxies, we see a measured velocity which is twice the expected velocity. And that means in V squared, which is the potential, V squared over R is the force, it's a factor of 4. So Newton's law of gravity as applied to luminous matter is failing by a term of order 1, and not by a term of order 10 to the minus 8. Moreover, if these were the only data that Newton had, then you would not have been able to extract out that inverse square law in the first place. And how could that have happened? Well, suppose the Earth were the only planet in orbit around the sun, and we didn't have all the other planetary orbits. It would have been very hard to find the 1 over R squared law. If we had these data, it would be very hard to find the 1 over R squared law. Nonetheless, the conviction of the community is that the 1 over R squared law is good, and therefore, if there is a problem, then you have to do something, and the something that you have to do follows from another theorem of Newton. Namely, if you have a sphere of material, spherical distribution of material, the potential at that point only depends on the material inside the sphere, and what is outside decouples. Therefore, if you want to modify the orbit of these particles here, you have to put some material here. You don't put the material over there where the visible matter is, because Kepler falls outside the visible matter. You have to put the dark matter where the visible matter isn't. And you have to put four times as much dark matter as you put luminous matter. So that was the original problem. I'll come back to a possible solution to it. I've just listed the 3M solutions, the work by Milgram, the work by John Moffat, the work by myself, have developed a formalism that can fit these data. I show you one set that fits, and these are no parameter fits, and they're with no dark matter. I'll discuss them later on where they come from. But nonetheless, what you discover is there are phenomenological formulae which can allow you to explain these data without ever needing to introduce dark matter. They all have the feature that when you go back to the solar system, all of these modifications to Newton all disappear, and you come back to standard solar system physics. So I'll come back. That's the galactic dark matter problem. However, it turns out that this is not the most severe dark matter problem. The most severe one is the cosmological one. But I mention them both because what I'm going to do at the end is try to show you that the two problems can be treated simultaneously. Now, everybody is well familiar with this wonderful set of data. People wanted to explore the Hubble plot, Hubble's idea. You plot distance as a function of velocity. You want to explore it to see how does this curve behave. You should know that on this scale, Hubble's original measurements were down here somewhere, and he saw a straight line. That straight line continues. Measure that straight line, you get the value for the Hubble parameter, and this is the number that today is the quoted number. And then if you go out far enough, then you would see this curve start to depart from the straight line. It had always been believed that the curve would bend this way. That's called a decelerating universe. But what, of course, was found was an accelerating universe, and this came as a great source of surprise and dismay to the community. So let me describe to you exactly what's involved. Cosmology, in its primitive terms, is very simple. We want to know the shape of the universe. There are three possibilities: flat, closed, or open. And we want to know the expansion rate of the universe. How does this system behave as a function of time? This is all embodied in a very simple metric. The s squared is dt squared minus r squared of t, dr squared over 1 minus kr squared plus r squared dr. This very simple metric contains the k and contains the r of t. We heard a talk yesterday indicating that we're beginning to see some possible departures from this when we look at the anisotropy of the CMB. But for the cosmic background itself, the universe on the larger scales, it seems that this is a very good description. And cosmologists have been very interested in determining k and in determining r of t. The first derivative of r of t is called the Hubble parameter. That was measured by Hubble. The second derivative, you'd like to find it. This is called the deceleration parameter. The second derivative is the change in the first derivative. Therefore, to measure the second derivative, you have to measure the first derivative at cosmologically separated distances. To go out to cosmologically separated distances was very hard to achieve, and it was only finally achieved in the last few years with the discovery of these supernova data. And so they were able to measure the second derivative, and to their surprise, the second derivative was found not to be negative, but to be positive. Okay. And that's the enigma. As a theory, standard gravity, which everybody here is well familiar with, simply says that for galaxies, for quasons, we have del squared phi equals rho, and Einstein converts this into a covariant form, r mu nu minus a half g mu nu r alpha times 1 over 8 pi g, there's a 1 over g there, is equal to t mu nu. These are the Einstein equations. The Einstein equations are the covariant writing of the Poisson equation as seen by an observer who's accelerating. Allow those equations to hold. You apply them to cosmology, and you discover that the analog of the Poisson equation for cosmology is called the Freeman equation. R dot squared plus kc squared is r dot squared omega m plus omega lambda. Omega m is the familiar rho m over 8 squared, and omega lambda, if it exists, is the cosmological concept of breaks. You can take this theory as is. You calculate the deceleration parameter. It's n over 2 minus 1, omega n minus omega lambda. Ordinary matter has n equals 3, so n over 2 minus 1 is positive. Omega n is positive, g Newton is positive, rho n is you and me, we're positive. So q would be expected to be positive, and what was found was the q was negative. To understand a possible q negative, you introduce this extra term, this omega lambda. If lambda is taken to be positive, then q can go negative. So that's the basis for saying, if we want to have deceleration, we will need a cosmological constant. What makes the cosmological constant different from rho m? It doesn't depend on the expansion radius. It's the pure constant, and that pure constant is achieved by its having a negative rather than a positive expression. So the very fact that acceleration c, namely the q, is positive, leads you to the notion that there has to be some material in the universe with negative pressure. How much? The Einstein equations tell you how much. You now take this theory, you've got the omega m, and you've got the omega lambda. You can solve the theory. Lambda's a constant. Rho m is 1 over n, 1 over r cubed. And you try to fit those data, and this is the confidence list that you get. The original results as announced by Perlmutter. What you discover is, if you just allow omega n to vary, then the best fit that you can get is actually with omega n negative. Remember, omega n is g times rho m, and that's therefore referred to as anti-gravity. Keep that in mind, we'll return to that point later. Nobody likes omega n negative, therefore you introduce omega lambda, and the best fit region then is around here, the famous 0.7, the famous 30% omega m, and 70% dark energy. Why is omega m called dark matter? Because you can count how much luminous matter there is in the sky by just looking at the galaxies, and you find that the very best omega m could be no more than 4% of the total, and therefore at least 20% has to be invisible, hence the large amounts of dark matter. So this is where we appear to be. Now, for the purposes of this talk, I only need one piece of information from these data. Not where we are, but where we are not. We are not here. We are not at omega n equals 1, omega lambda equals 0. Once we are not at 1, 0, we are in some trouble. And I will explain, we can be in different troubles depending on where we are, but no matter where you are in this picture, you are in some problem. And none of those problems have yet been solved. So let me describe what those problems are. We go back to our equation. For r dot squared plus k is r dot squared omega m. If we measure omega m luminous, that's you and me, it's of the order of 0.04. That's what it is, if you add it up. Can't be much more than that, and it's not much less than that. Now, according to the standard theory, there is a big bang. When there is a big bang in the very early universe, r dot is infinite. If r dot is infinite, it doesn't matter what k is. In the early universe, omega m plus omega lambda must be equal to 1, because we have infinity, infinity. Therefore, you're led to a rather disturbing conclusion. Omega m plus omega lambda, t equals 0, is equal to 1. Now, forget omega lambda for the moment. If omega m is 1 in the early universe, why is it after 10 billion years that it's only dropped to 0.04? Why didn't it go to 0 in the early universe directly, because the universe has expanded ever since? That's called the flatness problem. Solution was given by Goof. Beautiful solution. If k just happens to be 0, it's a little bit more sophisticated than that, but if k is 0 and omega lambda is absent, then omega m is always equal to 1. And therefore it stays up. It's one in the early universe, it's one in the current universe, it's one in every universe. However, that pays a price. That means you need 96% dark matter. But at least if the universe is 1, 0, omega n equals 1, omega lambda equals 0, you are in fantastic shape. Because then you can understand why omega n is of order 1 today. What we've learned from those data is that 1, 0 is excluded. The one place where we could have said that after 10 billion years, you could arrive at our current universe with a matter density of order 1 without having to fine-tune the initial conditions to something like 1 part in 10 to the 60, without having to do that, would work if omega n were 1 and omega lambda was 0. The supernova data prove conclusively that the one thing that ain't the case is 1, 0. If you take the original 54 data points of Perlmutter and his group, the chi-squared for this point here is 128. The chi-squared for this point here is about 56. So, 128 minus 56 is 72. So, 1, 0 is off the data by 72 standard deviations. And that's the only thing you need to know. Now, suppose we now say we want to save this picture by including lambda. Well, then you're left with omega n plus omega lambda is equal to 1. Now, how can you maintain omega n plus omega lambda is equal to 1 at all times? That you can do if k is 0. But the ratio of omega n to omega lambda, omega n over omega lambda, which is rho m over lambda, remember, and this will be important in what follows, g drops out of the ratio. The ratio of the cosmological constant to rho m is a pure number. So omega m over omega lambda is rho m over lambda. It's a pure number. And now, if this number is to be such that omega m and omega lambda are of the same order of magnitude today, then back in the early universe, omega m must have been 1 plus order 10 to the minus 60, and omega lambda must have been order 10 to the minus 60. The only way that omega lambda and omega m could be of the same magnitude today is if somebody fixed the initial conditions to fix the initial value of omega m and omega lambda to 1 part in 10 to the 60 to allow for the fact that we've been expanding for 10 to the 10 years. So as soon as you depart from 1, 0, which you have to depart from, no matter where you go, you are in a universe which only has a 1 part in 10 to the 60 chance of evolving into an omega m today, which is of order 1, but not 1.
So just a question.
Yes.
If I didn't know anything about microwave background.
Yes.
I would say this picture.
Yes.
The evidence for the steady state universe, which you haven't plotted.
I'm going to come back to this point in a moment. Okay. Yes. The correct statement that Jao's making is that on its own, this doesn't force you to 0.3.7. What forces you to 0.3.7 from this data is only if you assume as well the existence of inflation, which puts you on that line. However, the CMB studies will also put us on this line. But as it stands, you can go anywhere, and I'll return to the solution. A solution in which omega m is 0 and omega lambda is 0.4 is actually very, very good.
No, I was thinking more like the steady state negative. It's an attractor as well.
You want to go down here?
They're using a tractor. It's an attractor as much as the other plane.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. There are. You can be at many different. From these data, as they stand, you can be anywhere along the confidence line. Absolutely. I'm not disputing that. However, what I'm saying is, I don't care where you are on that line. You're in trouble. Somebody else might be happy, but that doesn't matter. They shouldn't be that happy. Not yet, anyway. Okay. Now, so that's where we stand. We need to be somewhere on the universe, somewhere other than here,
if you won't allow me to let omega n go negative, then we need something else, and hence the existence either of dark energy or of a cosmological constant. But that creates another problem. The other problem is the value that you get for omega lambda that you need, namely an omega lambda of order 1. And I don't care that it's 0.7, I only care that it's of order 1. You then have a very big problem. And that is that particle physics is telling you that this ratio should not be of order 1. It should be of order 10 to the plus 60, if you follow electroweak theory, or possibly of order 10 to the 120, if you introduce quantum gravity in the conventional way. So what we're left with is particle physics is saying to you, omega lambda over omega n, they shouldn't be of the same order of magnitude. They should, omega lambda should be at least 60 times bigger than of order 1. It should be of order 10 to the 60, and you would realize immediately that if you had tried to fit these data with omega m of order 1 and omega lambda of order 10 to the 60, you would have the worst fits in the history of physics. So clearly that can't be done. However, why should omega lambda be this funny value of 0.7? And that's the cosmological constant problem. Now, I want to stress that the fine-tuning problem of initial conditions exists even if I were to take this funny solution where omega m is equal to negative and omega lambda is 0. There'd still be a fine-tuning problem. You still have to understand why it's of order 1 today. So there is a problem in the evolution equation. There's something complicated about the Friedman equation, the r dot squared plus kc squared. R dot squared plus kc squared is r dot squared omega n plus omega lambda. That evolution equation doesn't like the current value of omega n. Even if there's no cosmological constant, it won't like it. If you then put in a cosmological constant, then you've got a second problem, and that is the particle physics doesn't like the current value of omega lambda. So, as I said at the beginning, wherever you go, once you leave 1, 0, you are in some kind of trouble, but you can be in different troubles depending on where you go.
When you say particle physics doesn't like the value of omega lambda,
yes,
that's an issue of fine-tuning. I mean, there are, for instance, there
No. Particle physics suggests strongly the scale lambda is a
string theory. That's the question of fine-tuning. Even if I don't talk about string theory, I can always introduce some classical lambda which cancels the quantum contribution. Of course, you have to fine-tune, but you can find...
What do you mean you can introduce?
You can write down...
I know you can add a lambda to this equation, but where did it come from?
That is the...
What's the physics of it? I will allow you to introduce anything you want if you can tell me what the physics is.
Well, it's a general covariant term, which I can just write down in the Lagrangian, which cancels what I have from quantum contributions. Furthermore, in string theory, there are lots of solutions where you can have an effective omega lambda, effective lambda, which is of the right order of magnitude. So
I am not aware of any one.
Okay.
I have yet to see any paper which has given me as a prediction 0.3, 0.7, and a statement by the string theorists that if it is shown that 0.3, 0.7 is not correct, we will know that string theory is wrong.
No, this is not the point. The point is that there are solutions to string theory which allow this possibility. It is not a solution to the problem of fine tuning.
I disagree.
Can I make a suggestion?
Yes.
Because Philip is only going to get even more provocative as he goes on. Let him tell the story and not interrupt it. And there will be lots of time to raise every issue.
I'm in agreement with you that the cosmological constant problem is described as a fine-tuning problem. But I wanted to show you that there's a second fine-tuning problem as well, even if it's 0. Now, never mind all the fancy words, and never mind all the string theory. How do we know if this is right? Well, lambda is does not redshift, and rho m does. Therefore, if you go to the earlier universe, rho m becomes bigger, yet lambda doesn't get bigger. Therefore, my result of a moment ago, my result of a moment ago, that Q is positive, Q is negative today because omega lambda wins, in the earlier universe, omega n will win because it blue shifted backwards. Therefore, you have a prediction. You have a prediction, and the prediction is, if the standard theory is right, you must see deceleration above a redshift of 1. That's the prediction, independent of any theoretical considerations. There's a very strong prediction that above a redshift of 1, you must see the restoration of deceleration if omega lambda is 0.7 today. So there's an experimental test. This test, I will discuss how far we've gone with it in a moment, but for the present time, it's for the next 5 to 10 years, and that is the test. Unless deceleration is restored above a redshift of 1, you will know that 0.3, 0.7 cannot be right. I didn't want to get into a fight with you, but I would like the string theorists to make a statement that if deceleration is not seen above a redshift of 1, we would know that string theory is incorrect. That is all I'm asking. Will you sit down and say, this is the prediction? Because I'm going to give you, in the moment, a theory which will predict categorically that the universe must be accelerating above redshift of 1, just as it was below a redshift of 1. Why? Because if you want to have no fine-tuning, then there's nothing special about the current theory. So I'm going to present to you in a moment a theory in which acceleration persists above a redshift of 1, and therefore it's a completely testable and falsifiable theory.
Isn't there flat news for other observations?
What?
Isn't there flat news for other observations?
We'll go one step at a time. This is the only prediction that I know which is completely theory independent. This is completely kinematic. Yes. There are dynamical challenges as well, and I will list all of them at the end. So where's the problem? Where do the problems come from? The problems come from the existence of the Big Bang. It's the Big Bang singularity which is forcing us into this fine-tuned universe today. Secondly, it comes from the assumption that if you know lambda, that the omega that is associated with it is just multiplied by g, the g that you measure in the Cavendish experiment in a laboratory. Now, I'm going to argue that 30 years of hard work in particle physics have led us to the view that the natural scale of particle physics is a TeV scale, and that's the scale of Weinberg-Salam symmetry breaking, and that when the universe cools down, it will go through a phase transition at that temperature, and therefore I would expect the free energy that would be liberated in such a phase transition to be of order a 10 to the 15 degree temperature, 1 TeV, and a black body of 10 to the 15 degrees has a lambda of order 10 to the 60. So I'm going to say everything we know in physics says the lambda is of order 10 to the 60. And everything we know from observation says that omega lambda is of order 1. So how can we bypass that? Well, the answer is maybe you have to change G. Maybe the G that controls cosmology is not the G that controls Cavendish. Maybe the cosmological G is totally different. And therefore, what we are measuring in cosmology today is not the cosmological constant. We're measuring omega, which is G times lambda, namely the amount by which the cosmological constant gravitates. The conventional picture that everybody follows is to say G is given, and therefore lambda has to be made small. And I say no, if lambda is given, then G has to be made small. And so the alternative view that I'm going to pursue is that G Newton is not a fundamental constant of nature. This is not an unprecedented idea, because G Newton carries a dimension, and there is another coupling constant which carries a dimension, G Fermi, which is also not fundamental. We now believe that G Fermi is a dynamically induced parameter which controls low energy physics, and I'm going to suggest that G Newton is only something which controls low energy physics, and the cosmology is controlled by a totally different G, and I'm going to show you in a moment how that totally different G can be altogether smaller than the G of Cavendish. So, my diagnosis of the problem is that the problem occurs because G is fundamental, the problem occurs because you use the Friedmann evolution equations for all times, and you assume standard gravity at all epochs of a cosmic evolution. So I'm going to question that possibility. Now, when I do so, and that's my diagnosis. My diagnosis is, and the talk will stop at this point, the problem exists precisely because you've continued Einstein gravity from the solar system all the way out to cosmology, and then you run into problems, and you have to work very hard to try to cure them. Now I'm going to suggest a different continuation, and as Lee said a moment ago, now we enter into the realm of speculation. But before I go any further, let me state again. We develop a theory of gravity from study of the solar system and study of weak relativistic corrections to it called Einstein-Newton gravity. We continue it to galaxies, we run into the dark matter problem. We continue it to cosmology, we run into the cosmological constant problem. We continue it to the early universe, we run into the flatness problem. We continue it to strong coupling, we run into the singularity problem. We continue it far off the mass shell, we run into the renormalization problem. Conclusion, you just may have the wrong extrapolation. So every time we extrapolate standard gravity beyond its origins, we encounter some other problem. All of these problems, I'm not in disagreement with you, they may all be solved. I don't say they won't be, but I'm saying that the origin of the current dark matter and dark energy problems lies in that extrapolation. It's only as good as the extrapolation, and the difficulty with the extrapolation is at every stage, when you try to apply the standard theory using luminous matter alone, you get a contradiction which you try to resolve by introducing something new, such as dark matter or dark energy. If somebody could tell me in advance, here is the dark matter in a galaxy, now go ahead and measure the velocity, this is what you've got to get. That's never done. You measure the velocity, you find that you don't fit it, you invent the dark matter, and then you say, aha, I fit the velocity. But you haven't learned anything, because there's no independent check as of yet on galactic or larger scales where you can invoke dark matter in a predictive way. So that is where the problem is, and it's in the extrapolation. What will happen in the future remains to be seen, but since people have not found dark matter, maybe they will in 3 weeks, but right now that hasn't happened, so it gives theorists the opportunity to contemplate alternatives. What would drive you to an alternative? You know two things. You know that the metric describes the gravitational field. You know the geometry in the vicinity of the sun is given by the Schwarzschild solution. That I regard as absolutely paramount. Therefore, you don't generalize Newton, you can only generalize Schwarzschild. You cannot not have Schwarzschild as the correct low energy limit for solar systems. That's my given. Now I take a clue from particle physics. We know particle physics T mu nu. It's SU3 cross SU2 cross U1. That's what it is. And it's a theory with quarks and gluons, with dimensionless coupling constants, and with masses generated dynamically. You write the Maxwell equations. The Maxwell equations describe a massless photon, as written down by Maxwell, massless the mode. It moves on the light cone. The light cone is not just Poincaré invariant. The light cone is conformal invariant. The equations of Maxwell are conformal invariant. You write the Maxwell equations in a gravitational field, they remain conformal invariant. You take the massless Dirac equation, it is conformal invariant. You make the massless you write the massless Dirac equation in an external gravitational field, it remains conformal invariant. Why? The Dirac algebra is SU22, and that's homomorphic to O42, which is the conformal group, which is the full symmetry of the light cone. So naturally, in 3 cross 2 cross 1, with massless quarks and gluons, as coupled to an external gravitational field, that theory happens to be locally conformal invariant. Therefore, one might naturally think that if you have such an object, and it is the source of something else, then the something else should be conformal invariant too. But the Einstein equations are not conformal invariant because of the presence of the fundamental Planck scale. If I were to follow the suggestion of a moment ago and add in a cosmological constant, it has dimension 4, that would also break the conformal symmetry. So suppose I make this wild statement, wild speculation. It's a W-E-Y-L-E-D speculation. It was originally proposed by Weyl. Maybe the universe is conformal invariant. And maybe the gravitational theory is conformal invariant. Weyl proposed this back in 1918, just 2 years after Einstein wrote down general relativity. And Einstein objected vigorously, saying, well, that's very nice, but not all particles in the universe are massless. And nobody knew how to handle that until we discovered spontaneous breakdown. Now we know that you can have a theory with no mass in the Lagrangian and yet get mass in the solution by getting mass in the vacuum. So I'm going to propose that maybe gravity is a scale-free theory and that the scales that we recognize in gravity come about by spontaneous breakdown. Why would you want to consider that? The equivalence principle, which holds once gravity is a metric theory, tells you that the inertial mass and the gravitational mass are equal. Weinberg-Salam tells you that the inertial mass is dynamical. Therefore, the natural conclusion is, well, maybe the gravitational mass must be dynamical too, but there is one gravitational mass which is not dynamical, that's the fundamental Planck mass. Conclusion, introduce a symmetry that will eliminate the Planck mass. You get a second bonus. The same symmetry also eliminates the cosmological constant. Guess what happens? Oh, I did? Oh. Oh my god.
Nobody's reacting.
Ah, okay. I can do this, you know.
No.
Oh, this happens with my cell phone.
Thank you.
Okay. So, if I take the view that all mass scales in the universe are dynamical, then I discover that there is no Planck scale, and there can't be a fundamental cosmological constant. So we have a symmetry which sets the cosmological constant. Now, you may dislike that proposal, but then you have a problem. And your problem is this. Why should all other mass scales be dynamical? Who decides to make 3 cross 2 cross 1 have dynamical mass scales and gravity to have a kinematic one? Maybe that's the way it works, but somebody's got to tell me how. So that's the dilemma if you don't like conformal gravity. Of course, whether or not you should really like it is not because it might look philosophically nice, but because it may or may not fit data. Now, Weyl made a discovery, and this is an extraordinary discovery. From the Riemann tensor, which describes whether space-time is flat or not, you can subtract off various pieces, products of the Ricci tensor and the metric, and construct the so-called Weyl tensor. What Weyl discovered was that if you take the metric, G mu nu, and you let it go to e to the 2 alpha of x, g mu nu of x, then when you do that, the Riemann tensor and the Ricci tensor are second derivative functions of the metric. They pick up derivatives of alpha. But the Weyl tensor, C mu lambda mu mu kappa, goes into e to the 2 alpha of x, C lambda mu mu kappa. The Weyl tensor is conformally covariant. So the Weyl tensor is, to a conformal transformation, what the Maxwell tensor is to a gauge transformation. Then you can construct an action. As always, to make the theory covariant, you need to contract lower indices with upper indices, so you're led to a C-squared theory. This theory is the only action that you can write down in four dimensions. It's a unique action, which is a locally conformal invariant gravitational action. C has 2 derivatives, C-squared has 4 derivatives, d4x. It means that the theory has a dimensionless coupling constant. Therefore, I can write down for you a theory of gravity with a dimensionless coupling constant called conformal gravity. Two things are known about it. One is that because the coupling constant is dimensionless, the theory is renormalizable. And two, when you calculate the gravitational beta function, you will find that it is negative. You often hear the statement that there is only one asymptotically free field theory in four dimensions. That statement is not true. There are two. One is Yang-Mills, and the other is C-squared gravity. But only one of them has a second-order wave equation. There's a second theory with a fourth-order wave equation, because these are fourth-order theories. And this theory is also asymptotic. Fourth-order theories have ghosts. Are thought to have ghosts, and I will try to return to that point in a moment. Let me tell you straight away that I have shown that this particular theory doesn't have a ghost, but nonetheless, that's another discussion which I hope to be able to excuse me. So suppose you buy me conformal gravity. Then the rules of gravity are very simple. You write down the action, you do the variation with respect to the metric, you get a rank 2 tensor. It's a god-awful rank 2 tensor. Here it is. And fortunately for me, DeWitt did the calculation, and so I just copy it out of his book after I checked it, and so this is correct. And you see that it contains derivatives of C. Now, there is a theorem, and this is where the equivalence principle comes in. There's a theorem. You take any general coordinate action you want. You vary with respect to the metric, and the function that you get, the W mu nu, obeys A, the anti-identity. It's true for any action, any pure metric action. It is obviously true for the Einstein-Hilbert action because that's a special example of a general coordinate scalar action. But any theory with an action which you construct a rank 2 gravitational tensor by functional variation of the metric will give you a rank 2 tensor which is covariantly conserved in the gravitational background without needing to impose the equations of motion of the theory. Okay. Now, I mentioned to you a moment ago that I have this god-awful mess, and then you see immediately if I'm in the vacuum where T mu nu is zero, if I let the Ricci tensor be zero, then all of its derivatives are zero, and you come to the startling conclusion that the Schwarzschild solution is an exact solution to the conformal gravity theory. Startling discovery, it was pointed out by Eddington in 1920. So Schwarzschild is an exact vacuum solution to this theory. The Schwarzschild metric, if you just solve it, has a metric which goes like G00 is 1 over GRR, is 1 minus the constant over R, and that's the Newton potential. Therefore, without doing any work, you are guaranteed that this theory has a good Newtonian limit. What you've also learned is 1 over R has nothing to do with Poisson and nothing to do with Einstein.
Do you have a Birkhoff theorem as well?
No.
No?
No. I have to pick my words very carefully. I believe the answer is no, even though I've seen papers which say that it is. And I have to study them and see whether they're correct.
So,
we won't need it. You can relax. You're going to see in a moment that it's irrelevant because there are other solutions to this theory which are not asymptotically flat.
Okay.
And the asymptotic non-flatness is going to be very important in the development. Okay. But nonetheless, that's the theory, and I announce it to you straight away, that in the vacuum you get the Schwarzschild solution, but now you go ahead and you solve the theory, and correct remark here, if R mu nu is zero, then W mu nu is zero, but not the other way around. If W mu nu is zero, then only the derivatives of R are zero. And therefore, R itself need not vanish. I had a collaborator called Dimas Kazanis. We were eager to know what did the other solutions look like. And let me tell you that when we were through, we found that the exact solution to the theory was 1 minus a constant over R plus a second constant times R. That's the exact solution to the theory. No other solutions. Now, what you then see, if you're a particle theorist, is, wow, I've given you an asymptotically free theory whose exact potential is shown. Namely, I've derived confinement. And it's absolutely correct. The confining potential is the exact solution to the theory. Now, I will only tell you straight away that if you now take this theory and you recognize there can be a regime that departures from Newton, grow with distance, and therefore, for small distances, you're back to Newton. For large distances, you see departures from Newton, and the beautiful fits that I showed you right at the beginning are basically the fits to that potential. It's a little bit more complicated than that, but these fits are the fits to conformal gravity, using the conformal gravity potential to modify Newtonian mechanics and Newtonian dynamics on galactic distances.
Are there any free parameters in it?
Only you have to specify gamma once, yes.
So for all the curves?
Yeah. For all of them, yes. Yes, but the same way you specify one beta for the sun. And then you ask how many stars do you have in the galaxy. Yes.
So everyone seems to agree, maybe not everyone, but the transition to this flattening is actually an acceleration, is not the reason?
Okay. I'm going to get to that in a moment. The so-called Milgram acceleration is equal to this gamma zero, which I haven't even told you what it is yet, times c squared. Right. A fundamental acceleration is the same as c squared times a fundamental distance. Yes. And what you see here is, if this is the potential, if this is the acceleration is constant, and that's the universal acceleration. So I'm not going to I'll try to discuss it, but it's going to be tricky in the time allowed.
This one over R term there.
Yes.
I mean, the term of the constant you interpret as a mass. So
I don't interpret it as a mass because you didn't either. The Schwarzschild solution is 1 minus constant over R. That constant is the Schwarzschild radius of the source. Some people call it mg over c squared. But you never use that piece of information for the solar system. When you tell me that the sun contains 10 to the 57 protons, you have measured the Schwarzschild radius from the planetary orbits, divided it by g of Cavendish, and come up with the value m, which was 10 to the 33 grams, and therefore there's 10 to the 57 protons.
It's the
Keplerian mass. But the Schwarzschild solution doesn't know that. And the fitting to the solar system planetary orbits doesn't know it either.
So my
the sun provides a radius and not a mass. Yes.
Okay, my question was the gamma. Do you have a interesting interpretation?
Yes. 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 If you solve the equation del squared phi is equal to rho, you're going to have to give too many talks today. But you've got to allow me extra time because you keep on asking. Del squared phi equals rho, you know how to
solve. You're asking the wrong person.
No. You have to ask me.
Okay.
Now, if you solve del squared phi equals rho, you get phi is minus beta over r. If you solve del 4 phi is equal to rho, you get phi is minus beta over r plus gamma times r. If you solve del 6 phi is equal to rho, you get phi is minus beta over r plus gamma r plus delta r cube. In other words, it doesn't matter what order Poisson equation you take, you always get a 1 over r. Plus,
additional terms if you go higher. Those additional terms are in, when you integrate the Poisson equation, they're related to moments of the source. So when you have a higher derivative theory, you explore more of the moments of the source than you usually do. In the standard theory, you only explore integral of r squared dr times rho. In this theory, you also explore r to the 4. If you wanted to go higher, you'd explore r to the 6. Allow me only to tell you that del 4 phi equals rho happens to be the non-relativistic limit of the conformal gravity theory. Yes, and that's how these things work. Okay. Yeah. But let's go back to the cosmology, because this is, in a sense, is the more interesting.
Can I just ask?
Yes, please.
Are you saying that the number of atoms in the sun is different from what we should assume?
No, I'm telling you that nobody knows how many atoms there are in the sun.
I can permit this, because there is a story still to come.
Yes.
And we can go on for a while, but I don't want to trap everybody here. So I think we should let Philip tell the outline of the whole story, then we can query details.
Yes. The answer is, this will give you the same answer, but I'm trying to show you that in principle it didn't need to. So now we notice something about this theory, and I'm going to show you how to solve this cosmology. It depends on the Ricci tensor, as written this way. Also, W mu nu depends on C and its derivatives. However, there's something you learn very quickly about the Weyl tensor. The Weyl tensor vanishes in a geometry which is conformal to flat. The standard cosmology, the Robertson-Walker for arbitrary order of t and k, is conformal to flat, and therefore in the standard cosmology, C vanishes, so do its derivatives, and therefore W mu nu is vanishing, and therefore in the standard cosmology, T mu nu is zero. So the conformal gravity theory boils down to just one equation, T mu nu equals zero. Once I introduce a mass source, as I did over here, then the conformal symmetry is broken by the presence of the mass, and then the equations of fourth order, like I just showed you over here. But for the standard cosmology itself, because the universe is so uniform, modulo things we learned yesterday, because the universe is so uniform, it is a theory in which the energy momentum tensor is zero. It's created out of nothing. Now, T mu nu equals zero is not a trivial equation in this theory. And the reason that it's not a trivial equation is because matter has to also be conformally coupled in the conformal theory. Well, what will we have? We certainly have the usual fermion, coupled to the spin connection, coupled to gauge bosons as needed. You can have it, you carve a couple to a scalar field. Turns out, the scalar field kinetic energy is not conformal invariant under S goes to E to the alpha of S, X times S. It's not conformal invariant. You make it conformal invariant by adding on this one extra term, the minus the 12 F squared R alpha alpha. Those of you who are as old as me will recognize this as the new improved energy momentum tensor of Coleman, Callan, and Jakeef. This is the improvement. Okay. So what we discover is the energy momentum, the action contains fermions, to be the generic example of matter, coupled to the scalar field. A scalar field could have a self-energy, that's allowed by the conformal symmetry, and finally, a back reaction on the Ricci scale. The entire discussion that will follow is predicated on this minus sign. This minus sign drives the theory. Why? We calculate the energy momentum tensor the usual way, varying the action with respect to the metric, go into a solution where the scalar field is a constant, and you get this particular energy momentum tensor. You take the fermions, distribute them as an incoherent perfect fluid, and that gives you the usual perfect fluid. The self-energy of the scalar field gives you what's usually called the cosmological constant, and the back reaction of the scalar field on the geometry. What you notice here is you have an Einstein term, a kinetic energy, a kinematic fluid, and a cosmological constant. They all add up to zero, and therefore the equation of conformal cosmology is exactly the one we've been using all along. It's the Einstein equation. The Einstein tensor is equal to the energy momentum, the energy of the perfect fluid, the rho n, plus a cosmological constant, but with one big change. And the one big change is that if you wrote this as an Einstein equation, what I'm calling 1/6 S0 squared is usually called minus 1 over 8 pi g. So I'll call this g effective, and therefore the g effective on this theory for cosmology is minus 1 over S0 squared. So it is negative, it is not attractive, it is repulsive. It is repulsive gravity. And the G effective has this very, very special feature that as you make the scalar field bigger, namely, the bigger the vacuum expectation value you give to the scalar field, the TEV region, the smaller you make the gravity. The bigger the cosmological constant, the smaller it gravitates. So the theory self-quenches. So in this theory, the cosmological constant is what you think it is. It's a TEV region scale, but the gravity that it produces is not what you think it is. But it's gravity with a negative g. And I asked you right at the beginning to remember that I showed you that you could solve the theory. You could fit the supernova data with negative g. And here we suddenly have a theory with negative g. Now, I'm not the first person who realized that g was negative in conformal gravity. However, everybody who's gone before me has always thought that this was the g for all gravity. This is not. This is the g when the Weyl tensor is zero. When the Weyl tensor is non-zero, that solution is related to moments of the Weyl tensor. And they can be a totally different sign. So having this g be negative when the Weyl tensor is zero does not mean that the g that you get when the Weyl tensor is non-zero is also negative, because this g is not fundamental. So the demarcation here is the universe is homogeneous and isotropic. Sitting on top of it are fluctuations. The fluctuations attract each other attractively. So even though the background, the homogeneous part is repulsive, on it sits an inhomogeneous part which is attractive. And so you can have both attractive and repulsive gravity in the same theory, but you can't do it if you have a fundamental g.
So is this true for linear perturbations, or just for non-linear?
For the linear perturbations, things get a lot more interesting because they grow with time. And I'll come back to that at the end. Yes. The answer to your question is I have yet to... I'm sorry. Yes, it was true for linear perturbations. But, yes, that it's attractive. Right. Yes. And if you're going to ask me what does that mean for the CMB, unfortunately, I don't yet know. But you should ask me, because it's the most important question. Okay, so what we've uncovered is we have an evolution equation which is exactly the standard equation. It's exactly r dot squared plus k is r dot squared omega m plus omega lambda, where this time the omega m and the omega lambda are exactly what they were before, but with g replaced by g effective. And I ask you to keep in mind that the ratio didn't depend on g. Therefore, the ratio also doesn't depend on g effective. So if, for some reason, which I'll show you in a moment is the case, if it just so happens that g effective is 10 to the minus 60, then omega bar m would be of order 10 to the minus 60 times 1, which is 10 to the minus 60, and omega bar lambda would be 10 to the minus 60 times 10 to the 60, which is of order 1. And therefore, by changing g, but by not changing the relative amounts of rho and lambda, I totally evade having to understand why they should be equal, because they are not equal. And if you remember a moment ago, I had indicated to you that there were solutions
where omega n is zero and omega lambda is non-zero. So now you would say, well, of course, we know omega n is not zero. Well, the answer is we know it's not zero if it's calculated with the standard g. But rho n could be what you think it is. It could be you and me, and we just don't gravitate as much. Therefore, we don't need any dark matter. So we've eliminated at one go the cosmological constant problem, because now we said it can be big, but it doesn't gravitate as much. We've eliminated the dark matter problem, because we say there is luminous matter in the universe. It doesn't gravitate as much. Therefore, adding in dark matter is not going to change how much it gravitates, if we never needed it in the first place. But the proof of the pudding is, but can I get to omega lambda here? With my omega lambda, that's the thing I need to show you now. This theory is a very simple theory to solve. One, above all phase transitions, where there's no omega lambda, bingo. R dot squared is R dot squared plus K is R dot squared omega bar m. Omega bar m is negative, because it's the usual rho but multiplied by a G effective, which is negative. And therefore, if it's negative, K is negative. So having a repulsive gravitational G means you don't have a flatness problem. Why? Because if G is negative, there's no Big Bang. There's no initial singularity. Therefore, you never have to fine-tune the two sides. I published that result in 1992 in the Astrophysical Journal, pointing out that conformal cosmology had a negative cosmological G and had no flatness problem. And then a couple of years later, I showed it also had no horizon problem. And it does this without any need for inflation. Now we go below the phase transition. If there's no Big Bang, the universe expands, but from a finite maximum temperature, not from a small maximum, not from an infinite one. We know that. We now lower the temperature. We go through a phase transition, and I claim what we know from particle physics is we lower the free energy, and therefore lambda is negative. We drop below the critical point. Now, in the standard theory, you take lambda to be positive, because you need omega lambda to be positive, and that's G times lambda. In my theory, lambda's negative, because G effective is negative, and therefore G effective times lambda is still positive. So, as well as not understanding in the standard theory why omega lambda comes down from 10 to the 60 to order 1, not understood is why it should even be positive. Everything we know about phase transition says that lambda should be negative. But that doesn't mean that lambda is repulsive, because if its effective G is negative as well, then the effective omega lambda is positive again. Now that you know that omega lambda is positive, you are in a fantastic shape, because go back to the current unit, to the evolution equation. And then find it. Okay. What happens in the current universe? In the current universe, omega bar m over omega bar lambda is 10 to the minus 60. So in the current universe, you can forget the matter density. It's not that the matter isn't there, it's not contributing in any substantial way to the expansion. It acts as a true test particle. It responds to the expansion, but it doesn't affect the expansion. In the standard theory, the matter density responds to the expansion, but also causes the expansion. Here it's a test particle. If omega bar m is negative, and k is negative, which we showed already above the phase transition a moment ago, and k is a general coordinate scalar, therefore it doesn't change, then we are left with a fantastic result. Omega bar lambda must be less than 1. And so the theory has a remarkable property. That is, that no matter how big lambda is, G effective always readjusts so that omega bar lambda lies between 0 and 1. And all epochs, in all late epochs where the matter density is no longer important. So the matter density is important in the early universe before it's redshifted. In this theory, it redshifts away, you can forget about it, but the trace of its
presence is in the negative curvature of the theory that the theory must therefore have. That negative curvature leads you to an omega bar lambda, which is negative. Same story, you can determine the deceleration parameter, and you can show that it must lie between 0 and minus 1. Allow me only to tell you that now you've got enough information to solve the effective Friedman equation, and this is the expression that you get for the luminosity distance as a function of redshift, as parameterized in terms of the current value of the deceleration parameter, which must lie somewhere between 0 and minus 1 because of these considerations. So now you take this theory and you apply it to the data, and let me tell you, the lower curve is 0.7,
0.3, 0.7.
What are you plotting? What is the x? I'm plotting the same one I showed you before. Distance against the velocity, the power magnitude against redshift. The same one that we had.
Yeah.
It's the same one that I had at the beginning, but not with the log scale, unfortunately. Okay. So we plot distance against velocity. The lower curve is 0.3, 0.7. The lower curve is the best conformal gravity fit with Q0 is minus 0.37. One parameter fits all of the data. Only this is with a cosmological constant, which is huge, which is 10 to the 60. So you can fit the supernova data with a huge cosmological constant. You don't need to quench it. You need to quench the amount by which it gravitates. Now go back to what I told you right at the beginning. Yes, I'm sorry.
We have a time issue.
Oh, okay.
And we'll have time for discussion after as much as people want, but if you could give us just another 5 minutes.
Okay. All right. Just to show you the fits, the chi-squared for 0.3.7 is 57.7. The best conformal gravity fit is 58.63. The test. Now go above the redshift of 1. Remember, the Q was negative. The theory accelerates in all epochs. Therefore, above a redshift of 1, the conformal gravity theory will continue to accelerate, whereas the standard gravity theory decelerates. As soon as enough data points are available above a redshift of 1 as there are below, you have a good chance to be able to discriminate between the two theories. So if these conformal gravity ideas are correct, then we must see continuing acceleration. If the standard theory is correct, we must see deceleration. Now, there are some data points today. There are 9 points that have so far been found above a redshift of 1. And I'll just give you the chi-squared. 0.3.7 for 63 supernova above and below redshift of 1. 0.3.7 gives you 74.5. 0.37, the one I just used a moment ago, gives you 70.7. You want to make the standard model competitive with the 70.7, you actually have to reduce the 0.3 to 0.2 and the 0.7 to 0.8. What does that mean? The data are consistent with the standard model, but the fact that I had to adjust the omega lambda to make it a little bit bigger, and that's also present in Rees's paper where these data were announced, indicates that there's a little bit more repulsion than the standard theory would like. Not enough to hang your hat on yet, but it certainly shows that the data above a redshift of 1 that there are just as compatible with the conformal theory as the ones below a redshift of 1. So that's where the theory stands. Those are the predictions. And if these predictions are borne out, or the theory is invalidated, then we will have learned something very interesting, either way. Now, the one other issue that I wanted to talk about is the issue of, since these are fourth order theories, if you try to quantize them, you are ordinarily led into the issue of ghosts. It will take me, I would say, 10 minutes to do that, and so perhaps what's your preference? Is,
well, what
is,
I would
is
say,
to stop now?
What I would say is stop now.
Yes.
Let's have questions, and then people who want to stay and hear that will do so.
Okay.
Right.
So that's where the theory stands.
So I'm sure there are questions, comments. Here, Daniel.
Yeah, so sorry, I mean, there was a lot of stuff to cover, so I got kind of confused as to where a lot of these things were coming from. So maybe focus just kind of on the solar system and galaxy for
yes.
a moment. So the blackest solution, you said basically, is two constants that
yes.
come out. So where are those constants coming from?
If I integrate the equation del 4 phi equals rho, then the two integration constants are moments of the source. Moments of the source. Moments of the source. Yeah, moments of rho.
So, okay.
And so all I'm saying is that usually in the standard theory we think only one moment of rho is measured, namely the integral r squared dr times rho of r. In the fourth order theory, the integral of r4 dr rho of r is also measurable.
Okay, so
because it's basically the del 4 is a deeper derivative and it digs more into the source than del squared.
So does that mean that for other galaxies if you go get to say solar system
yes.
Where you just kind of have the 1 over r.
No. What I need to know is that the coefficient of the r term, which I fix from a galaxy, must be negligible on the solar system in order to not mess the solar system up. And that's exactly what happens. What I can do is this. What do you do in the standard theory? You fix the one integration constant. And you specify it for the sun, and then when you go to a galaxy, you just take 10 to the 11 of them, you work in the weak gravity regime, and you just add them up. So I say, okay, the sun has a second one. It has a gamma. And then when I go to a galaxy, I have 10 to the 11 of them. And I add them up linearly. In other words, I have to specify once and for all one integration constant for the sun for the second moment and one integration constant for the sun for the fourth moment.
Right.
But then I'm stuck because then when I take 10 to the 11 solar masses, I can't change those parameters anymore.
Okay, but for a different star.
Yes.
Then, so obviously the mass would be different. So
yeah.
Presumably, is the mass still getting the first constant?
Oh, okay. All you can say, if you think about Newton for the moment, what Newton did was he summed over a set of point sources. And he showed that the potential produced by a set of point sources is n times the potential produced by one of them. So I will fix once and for all the beta of a proton and the gamma of the proton. And then I scale up to the sun and then I scale up to a galaxy without any further action. But the beta of this proton and the gamma of the proton, I don't know yet how to relate them to moments of the proton because I don't yet have the dynamical theory.
Okay, fine. So at some point earlier in the talk, one of the questions you said that no one knew how many atoms were in the sun. So
if you were to say in the standard gravity theory that you say that I know the coefficient of the 1 over r for the sun, it's m times g, and you take g from Cavendish, then you determine n to be 10 to the 33 grams. And since the mass of a proton is 10 to the minus 24 grams, you infer that the mass of the sun has 10 to the 57 protons. However, that's if you could identify that coefficient as m times g. But that coefficient is not identified as m times g in this theory. I can define it to be m times g to make contact with the standard.
Yeah, but you said that you were assigning a particular beta and gamma to the proton.
Yes. What I do is the Schwarzschild radius of the proton is 10 to the minus 52 centimeters.
Right.
The Schwarzschild radius of the sun is 10 to the 5 centimeters.
So g is.
So I take the. Excuse me?
G is in there.
Yes. The Schwarzschild radius, as conventionally determined by m times g, is 10 to the minus 52 centimeters for the proton.
Right.
I'm going to define it to be the Schwarzschild number in this theory. And I'm going to say, okay, there are 10 to the 57 protons in the sun, and therefore the Schwarzschild radius of the sun is 10 to the 5 centimeters. But I don't need to do that. I only need to say that the Schwarzschild radius of the sun is 10 to the 5 centimeters, and that because that's all I need to fit the solar system. You can call it m times g, and you can backtrack to the proton m times g, but you don't need to. So I decline to do so.
But you do need to if you want to say anything about the galaxy, because otherwise you
can. Oh no! All I can say for the galaxy is I have 10 to the 11 suns.
Well, but I mean, the number, certainly the number of protons in different suns are different. We expect that.
Oh, okay. What you're asking is called the mass collide ratio problem.
It's making it much too complicated. He fixes a fundamental constant, which is the Schwarzschild radius of a proton. If we translate that back into our units,
I think I understand that, but I guess I'm kind of confused by your statement that all we need is the Schwarzschild radius of the sun. That's not true. You also need to make the assumption that the ratio between these things is somehow constant.
Because I already fixed that for the proton. Then I scale up by the same number of protons for both terms. For linearized gravity, I can just look, it's just n times the number of fundamental sources.
Yeah, okay, so that's fine, but I guess I'm trying to understand what kind of assumptions you're making.
I'm making the standard linearized gravity assumptions, only I'm doing it twice as good.
I have so many questions, I'm not sure which one to choose from.
Which answer would you like?
There are many tests that standard GR meet
yes.
that are outside. Well, there's a very crucial test that takes it outside of the solar system. Binary pulsar test. Which is very tricky because it involves two self-gravitating compact bodies moving in rapid motion, emitting gravitational radiation, and all of those aspects are well tested.
Let me try to answer this.
The question is,
yes.
I would really insist that you reproduce that success.
In my own papers, I insisted.
Okay,
but I want to answer you. It's not so bad as you say, as you think. While the binary pulsar is not in the solar system, the distance between the two stars is a solar system distance. So when I say solar system distance, I was including that. Why does the binary pulsar decay? The answer is, I don't know if anybody came to the talk yesterday, it decays because of gravitational radiation reaction, in which each star responds not to where the other star is, but to where it was. Why? Because gravity information is communicated at the speed of light. This is a completely covariant theory. Therefore, it will have retardation, and therefore, in this theory, the binary pulsar will slow down. The effect is of order mg over r to the 2.5, whatever it is, and so I'm going to get delta t over t is of order 10 to the minus 12. The problem is I can't calculate the coefficient. I don't know if I know what it is in standard theory. I've not been able to show yet that it's the same in this theory. And that's a definitive test of the theory, absolutely. And if I can't do that, then you can correctly complain that this theory is not right.
So you have a classically conformal invariant theory, and
yes.
Actually in the standard model, there is a sector which breaks conformal invariance, namely the Higgs sector. There is explicit mass there.
Yes.
But more importantly for you, I mean, any...
You didn't let me answer the first one.
Sorry.
You didn't let me respond to your first
question. Yeah, let me finish the question.
Okay, yes.
Because that's not the important question. And
yes.
The question is, if I try to quantize it, I invariably introduce a scale. I mean, these theories are not quantum mechanically conformally invariant. And your theory would also, if I introduce quantum effects, there will be... you will be breaking the conformal invariance.
Yes.
And finally, will be left with the same kind of fine-tuning issue that having that the usual cosmological problem introduces, except that you have it in your G rather than in lambda.
Okay. What you've asked is a 20-page paper I've written, so I'll try to answer you very quickly. In the standard theory, we introduce fundamental Higgs field with a double well potential because we don't know to do any better. The better that we know we need to do is to have the scalar field emerge as a fermion composite. We know how to do that in the BCS theory. We know how to do it with Technicolor. We don't yet know how to do it for weak interactions. In order for all masses to be dynamical, it must be the case that the conventional Higgs field is a dynamical fermion composite, the same way it is in the DC field. And I'm assuming that to be the case, I'm not showing it to be the case. The second issue is it's absolutely true that conformal and invariance and renormalization. Renormalization introduces a scaling breaks the conformal symmetry in the Lagrange. Now, what it doesn't do is it doesn't modify the infrared. It doesn't generate masses. If masses are to occur because of long-range order, it has nothing to do with anomalies, which are short distance. It turns out that the anomalies in the conformal theory are proportional to the beta function, the one that I told you was negative in the perturbation theory. If the beta function is zero, which means if the conformal invariance is restored with anomalous dimensions, which is what I'm assuming but not proving, then the conformal anomalies go away. So you can have a universe.
So you're saying that you have a theory with a beta function which is zero.
I'm saying is that for this theory to be a successful quantum theory, the beta function has got
to happen. Only theories that we know of which have these are supersymmetric theories. Again,
I would argue that we also know that we also know more about quantum electrodynamics, that it too can have a fixed point. I agree with you, and even by the levels of speculation that I've given you so far, that's an even higher order level of speculation. But it's certainly true this theory would require that.
Let me. I'm going to use my prerogative chair and give it up, and then give it up.
Yeah.
So because I think there are many, many questions people have. I think we should thank Philip and then turn it to a general discussion because some of us have to leave. Including me.
Okay.
So you'll be on your own, but I'm sure you'll do just great.
All right.